It's time for the fastest 15 minutes in the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Time for the Fastest 15. The first one is going to give you a sense of deja vu. At least it did me. Reading the story, I thought, I feel like I've read this story before, say about 8 or 9 months ago, and then 8 or 9 months ago before that, and then about a year before that, and a year before that, and a year before that. I feel like it's going back now for most of my life. And that is, the United States is getting ready to have another vote on the debt limit. Let's expand that debt limit, because the national debt is piling up. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi didn't rule out voting on a debt limit increase before the August recess, but she wants to raise the discretionary spending caps for fiscal 2020 before doing so. It's kind of a fascinating thing, because remember the last time around when Republicans had the majority, it was, you know what, you guys are spending too much, you terrible people, Democrats take over the House. Hey, we're all in favor of having this vote, but we want to spend some more money on this in this other spot first, which seems to be the wrong direction if you're concerned about, you know, say a tipping point in the number of trillions the U.S. can go into debt before money and inflationary problems become a big concern. Pelosi says, quote, let's see how the conversations go. We certainly do not want any thought of default on the part of the full faith and credit of the United States of America. I like how they and politicians of all sides do that. The full faith and credit of the United States of America. Like, you know, our fiscal house is in perfect order. Don't you worry about a thing. We're just going to spend a little bit more money here. And then she puts in a dig on the Republicans. There are those on the Republican side who've embraced that time and again. That's the shutdown situation. Estimates from the Treasury Department and the Congressional Budget Office put the deadline for raising the limit at sometime in October. But Pelosi's hoping to, because she'd get more leverage, House Democrats view as their best leverage is to extract higher non-defense spending. That's to merge the two deadlines in spending, so the administration has to play ball on appropriations in order to get the timely debt limit ceiling that they want. In other words, everybody agrees they want to spend more money, and that becomes the problem. Except, unlike a lot of people, I don't get as mad about the politicians on this. I get the same feeling about the people. Because if people were upset, they would say, no, we can't spend this money. But what happens is when politicians bring up reforms of government services that would actually make a dent in this kind of thing, which is you'd have to tackle entitlements and things of that nature, because they're the things that are big enough. You know, we're spending now money, you know, the future money, we're spending, you know, other generations' money. We refuse to do that. We have all this hysterical outrage and people freak out and there's all these headlines. So it's really our own fault. I mean, our representatives are a reflection of our own values there. Democrats insist on a non-defense number $100 billion more than the White House wants. There's no apparent budging on Democrats' adherence to about $647 billion in non-defense funds, which would be a 7% boost over the current year. The White House figure is 10% below fiscal 2019. So that's where the big disagreement is between the White House and Pelosi-led Congress right now. She also doesn't want to have a meeting. She says, I don't see any reason to have a meeting. They know where we are. We've met. We just anticipate some response from them. If there's no a reason to have a meeting, let's see what they have to say. But so far, all we need is a response from them. So, you know, again, she doesn't want to meet because she's pushing for the leverage. And that's what it comes down to. And it's too bad because eventually value has to take hold. There has to be a consequence for that kind of spending beyond your means. The ambassador from the United Kingdom has been in trouble after a leak of his confidential assessment of the Trump administration. He called the Trump administration's policy toward Iran incoherent, said the president might be indebted to dodgy Russians, and doubted whether the White House would, quote, ever look competent. Quote, we don't really believe this administration is going to become substantially more normal, less dysfunctional, less unpredictable, less faction-driven, less diplomatically clumsy and inept, he said. And this caused quite a stir, a lot of outrage amongst the White House and White House staff. CBS's Vicky Barker on the UK's response to the leak
Just who leaked the confidential emails that ended Sir Kim Darroch's ambassadorship remains under investigation.
I hope that those who were responsible will take a long, hard look at themselves and see what damage they may have done to their country.
British Cabinet Minister Liam Fox, former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, was the only top British politician to decline to support Darroch over President Trump. He's considered the frontrunner to be the next prime minister and is also said to have preferred someone else for the ambassador's job. Johnson says he's appalled at the leaks, but whoever the leaker is apparently wishes Boris Johnson well.
Okay, so everybody's upset about the leak, except apparently Boris, because he would have picked somebody else. Anyway, Trump, his response, the president's response to the UK ambassador documents was that he wasn't well-liked or thought of in the U.S. We will no longer deal with him. He welcomed the good news that the prime minister, Theresa May, was stepping down in a couple of weeks. He called the ambassador wacky and a very stupid guy. So in other words, Trump's response was the same response that he gives to anybody who insults him in any way. You know, they're stupid, didn't really like him anyway, stupid guy, nobody likes him, everybody likes me. And this has created quite a political pickle in the UK, because the question is, what do you do next? If you force the guy out, then it makes it look like you're caving to the Americans and they're bullying you into doing what they want. And if you don't, you've created the situation where for your closest ally, you've got someone who insulted the president or the chief executive of that nation. And how are they supposed to work with that administration if they're calling them incompetent and other things? By the way, it's interesting when he talks about the dysfunctional, unpredictable, faction-driven. In Art of the Deal, Trump talks about liking creating this kind of faction and division, because he thinks it makes a better strategy for better business productivity. Now, agree or disagree with it, I don't know, but that would be the argument, I think, that he'd make. The other thing is, the ambassadors are supposed to give their blunt assessments. And so it is a big deal for Britain because, you know, with this information leaked, what does it mean for other ambassadors who want to be able to share a blunt assessment of what they believe here? And he's talking about what's happening in the news, the dodgy Russian things, clearly a comment about the past Russian investigation and the rest. Now, the ambassador resigned from his post, saying he couldn't do his job in this climate. And Prime Minister Theresa May and the cabinet defended the ambassador.
I have told him that it is a matter of great regret that he has felt it necessary to leave his position as ambassador in Washington. Cabinet rightly gave its full support to Sir Kim on Tuesday. Sir Kim has given a lifetime of service to the United Kingdom, and we owe him an enormous debt of gratitude.
I just love listening to British Parliament, because you got the hear in the background and the complaints there. My guess is it was more like this. This is how it went. You know, for the full support, we gave him the full support and told him to get the hell out because now he's a problem. And the ambassador became a problem. And, you know, he had to look at the writing on the wall and say the only way out here is he can't be fired because it makes everybody look bad. He can't, he can't stay because he can't do his job. So his only course is resign. And that's what it ends up being. Emily Thornberry, spokeswoman on foreign affairs issues for the opposition Labour Party, said, quote, "The fact that Sir Kim has been bullied out of his job because of Donald Trump's tantrums and Boris Johnson's pathetic lickspittle response is something that shames our country." So, look, you know, divisions aren't just for the U.S. You know, the British, actually, they get pretty nasty in their conversations, and yet they've managed to stick around even longer than we have. So there might be hope for us all yet. And speaking of hopefuls, remember Middle Class Joe, Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, Middle Class Joe? He was interviewed on CNN, by CNN's Chris Cuomo, on whether or not he's in touch with the regular folks.
Is Joe Biden the right fit for this party at this time? They're coming at you not on policy, but the way you discuss policy, the phrases you use, that you are not in step with their lingo, let alone where they want to go.
Well, let me tell you, I think I'm more in step with the lingo than any of them. I was asked to go into 24 states, campaign for 69 candidates. The rest of them weren't asked to go in those places. You remember I got criticized. I said, we're going to win back the House of Representatives. We went in and beat Republicans head on. We took them on issues of health care. We went to their neighborhoods and made the case against them. You know, half of it, my dad would say,
Let me pause there. almost all of the Democrat work in the midterms was focused on. It wasn't about the specific issues. It was, we can't stand Trump. We dislike him. That was the message. And I also love how Joe Biden does his – this is when politicians like Biden do this thing where they create this scenario that never existed. You know, when – you know, I mean, a lot of people were mad at me by saying that we could win the House. You know, it's like, really? So a bunch of Democrats were just furious that you said you could take back the House of Representatives from Republicans. It's like, you know, if the Republicans came along, if Ted Cruz, if they lost the Senate, Ted Cruz came along and said, hey, you know what, Republicans, we can regain the Senate. A lot of people were mad at me for that. I don't think so. But it's this is a classic Biden turn of phrase because it makes him look bigger.
Going up, making the case. The idea that somehow we have decided that our system doesn't work anymore, which I'm hearing some of them saying, that we're going to, you know, pack the courts. We're going to fundamentally change the way I'm going to do what Trump did. You know, if we take control, I'm going to go in there and I'm just going to buy executive order. What are we talking about?
Now, remember, President Obama, who Vice President Biden served, said, you know, he had a pen and a phone. And he intended to use it. And he was governing essentially by executive order on many things, including immigration, where he said, well, Congress wasn't acting, so I'm just going to do these various things by executive order. Now, whether you agree or disagree with the policy, that's not the way it's supposed to work. Executive orders aren't just supposed to create massive legislation. Anyway, so that's Biden positioning himself as a man in touch with the people. He's campaigned everywhere. Nobody else has asked for that. He says the system isn't broken, and it certainly isn't. The Bidens earned $15 million in the 2 years after leaving the Obama administration. Remember, when he was in the Senate, he was middle-class Joe. As vice president, he was kept referring back to middle-class Joe. When he was vice president, his financial disclosure form showed that he and Joe Biden had between $303,000 to $1 million in assets and liabilities of between $560,000 and $1.2 million. So they were, you know, who knows, maybe a little in debt, maybe a little ahead, either way. But thanks to a multi-book deal with Flatiron Books for Joe Biden to write two books and one for Jill, the Bidens ended up buying a $2.7 million mansion in Rehoboth Beach in Delaware, a house with six bedrooms, multiple decks, and adjoins the state parks. You need six bedrooms and multiple decks if you want to have a small carbon footprint. You know what I mean? Because, you know, you want to keep it small. Anyway, so then he gave a bunch of speeches for all kinds of money, and he's currently worth $15 million. He had a VIP book experience that charged people more. He got $540,000 from the University of Pennsylvania for being listed as a Benjamin Franklin Presidential Practice Professor. So it pays to be an ex-politician. Let me put it that way. And it probably helps his presidential ambitions as well. And speaking of ambitious politicians, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC, as she is widely known, was asked about her disagreements with Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi had said, quote, all these people have their public whatever and their Twitter world. Pelosi told the New York Times that these people didn't have any following. They're four people, and that's how many votes they've got.
We have a select committee whose mission I was uncertain on, whose members take fossil fuel money. You know, it's beyond just a mere disagreement. I think there's a structural problem with it. And so... and there are plenty of other caucuses as well that work on climate issues. So I think that ultimately I'm fine with the decision, especially given the committee assignments that I was ultimately given, which were very intense and very rigorous. I was assigned to two of some of the busiest committees and four subcommittees. So my hands are full. And sometimes I wonder if they're trying to keep me busy.
Well, how did Pelosi react when you turned her down on being on that?
She was fine with it. She said, okay.
One of my favorite shows of all time, and I highly recommend it to anyone who, even if you have a light concern about policy, is Yes, Prime Minister and Yes, Minister. It's a British comedy show from the mid-80s to early 90s, I think. It came in two series. The Yes, Minister deals with a guy who's a minister of education, and then later he becomes prime minister, so it becomes Yes, Prime Minister. Why does this apply to this? Well, it's because... politics is basically a study of human nature and how human beings work and manipulate power. And the people who wrote the show, it's a comedy show, a little sketch comedy for, you know, it's about 20 minutes per episode or 25 minutes per episode. And they basically interviewed a bunch of former civil servants within the Thatcher administration, but it was both the Tories and the Labour Party. They got everybody involved. And they tried to base the show on the actual experiences of the civil servants, the politicians, and the public perception. So when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Congresswoman AOC, says, hey, I wonder if they're just giving me a bunch of work to be busy. There's actually an episode where there's an individual that's causing too much problems, and they just keep loading on all kinds of quote-unquote really important work to keep them busy so that they stop creating problems and get within the system. And so over and over again, when I watch this show, and then you're watching the news about various politicians, you'll see this, and for Democrats or Republicans, you start to see the parallels between these shows and what happens in the real world. And again, they're based on real world experiences, so you get kind of the same thing. Now, you know, if you're not used to British comedy, it might start off a little slow at first, but I guarantee you, stick with it, you'll never see politics the same way. Great show. And Ocasio-Cortez, I think the answer is yes. That's why they gave you a bunch of assignments that you don't like, just to keep you busy. Now, there's another answer that she gave here. This was quoted in Grabian, and I just wanted to read this text because I found it so confusing. AOC, this is AOC answering, you know, if it's better to be on the outside looking in or the inside looking out. She says it's better on the outside looking in. Why is that? And here's her answer. Quote, because given that none of those standards were met sitting on that committee, I would have to own anything. I would take responsibility for anything that comes out of that committee. And when the actual, my opinion, the structure of it is comprised in very deep ways, you know, it's not. I don't think it was like I'm going to take my ball and go home. It's we have a select committee whose mission I was uncertain on whose members take fossil fuel money. You know, it's beyond just a mere disagreement. I think there's a structural problem with it. And so, and there are plenty of other caucuses as well that work on climate issues. So I think that ultimately I'm fine with the decision, especially given the committee assignments that I was ultimately given, which were very intense and very rigorous. I was assigned to two of some of the busiest committees and four subcommittees, so my hands are full. And sometimes they're trying to keep me busy. I mean, when you read the text of it, it just becomes so jumbled and impossible to understand. And I think, you know, part of that is, this is someone who has extreme passions, and I admire the passion for that she has for politics and public policy, and she wants to help people, but I don't think she's really thought a lot through. And she hasn't considered the repercussions of many of her ideas, and so her mind's just racing all over the place, and she's jumping from topic to topic there and can't quite nail it down. Coming up, do you think the public should vote on who becomes the next King County Sheriff? Cairo's Carolyn Osorio joins us to talk about whether or not the option to elect the King County Sheriff is going to end. We'll talk about that next. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM in King County. We currently vote for King County Sheriff, and it's a process that seems to have been going fairly well. It's been that way for many, many years, as long as I can remember. But Cairo's Carolyn Osorio is here to explain why a change might be coming.
Yeah, so back in 1996, King County voters had their say. We want the King County Sheriff to be an elected official, not an appointed one. But that issue is back on the table, and many, like Randy Pepple, who's the executive director of Chiffwa, are wondering why.
The people said, we want to elect the sheriff, and the review commission, after a few years, says, no, we don't want the people to do that. And their rationale for doing so is very thin at best.
So to understand this process, we have to look at the charter commission. So every 10 years, the county executive appoints a commission to review the charter and make recommendations for amendments to the King County Council. Now, those items are passed to the council, and then they go to the voters for a final say. Now, I talked to Toby Nixon. He's a member of the Bipartisan Charter Review Commission. He's also on the Kirkland City Council, and he's the president of the Washington Coalition for Open Government. About why this past November, several commissioners proposed changing the sheriff back to an appointed position.
People who are the proponents of this idea like the fact that they can go anywhere in the country to find the most qualified person instead of being limited to only those who are already registered voters in King County for the past year, which is what you have to be to run for sheriff now.
And he says they're looking for some fresh blood.
There's also concern expressed that if you wanted to really reform the way the sheriff's office works, would you necessarily want to promote somebody from inside the department to do that? Somebody who has been immersed in that culture for their entire career? Or would you prefer to bring in somebody from outside, a reformer who would be able to make something like that happen?
But there are just as many arguments on the commission to leave well enough alone. Every county in Washington elects their sheriff. If this change is made, the people in King County will be the only ones who don't have a say in their sheriff. And the change would give a lot of power to the King County executive, who would then appoint a sheriff, and the candidate would then need approval from the King County Council.
It's probably the most controversial issue that we've been dealing with in terms of the number of factors that are being considered and the division amongst the commission in terms of trying to reach a consensus.
But he says he doesn't get why it's so controversial, because the sheriff doesn't make law. It's essentially an administrative position.
I have seen some emails float around and Facebook posts from groups like Shift Washington, and there's been some others that have started to raise this red flag about, oh, they're going to try to take away our elected sheriff.
So why are we talking about this now? Well, in late June, a poll was taken and enough commissioners gave the thumbs up to continue to discuss the issue. A draft ordinance to make that change has also been prepped, and commissioners will reconvene in September if they will recommend that change to the council for approval. And but Toby says it's not too late to weigh in.
It would be interesting if your story results in a lot of people in the community communicating to the commission their feelings one way or the other. It would be very useful to the commission to get more feedback, pro or con.
So does he tell you how to give that feedback to
yes,
the commission?
Yes. You go to charterreview@kingcounty.gov. We're going to be putting this up at mynorthwest.com. You know, there's a lot of issues surrounding, and even Toby, who says he's for it, said he was conflicted because he recognizes that he's been a little inconsistent himself about the appointed versus elected officials in King County.
I was the chair of the committee that ran a county initiative to make the director of elections a independent, nonpartisan elected office, because I felt it was important that the director of elections be independent of the county executive.
And he says that came out of the 2004 governor's election controversy.
There was a time during that ballot counting on the third recount where the county executive is alleged to have instructed the director of elections, who at that time was an appointee of the executive, instructed them to count a pile of ballots that had been marked invalid.
So it's an important position.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand what he's saying about, I feel conflicted as well. I mean, I like at the state level, you know, so many people have run as the education governor. I mean, Governor Inslee's claimed to be an education governor. Governor Locke claimed to be an education governor. Governor Christine Gregoire claimed to be an education governor. And yet we have an independently elected office of the superintendent of public instruction. And it seems to me that it would be better if that position was just appointed by the governor, because It's the paramount duty of the state. You're electing the chief executive. Why is the paramount duty of the state not under the governor? It just doesn't make sense. You've got and they've got an entire legislative building dedicated to themselves for bureaucracy, and I don't think that that's necessarily a healthy thing. So, but when it comes to this, I remain conflicted. I don't trust the King County Council to focus on the law and order issues, because they're so enmeshed in other kinds of politics. And from a conservative perspective, the King County Sheriff's Office, even though not currently, but it is one of the few places that someone who might have an R next to their name in a future election, like Congressman Reichert, for example, might actually achieve prominence, political prominence. And so from a political perspective, if you were on the left, if you're a Democrat, I could certainly see why, hey, look, if it was only an appointed position, you could guarantee that you're not going to get somebody who might run against you later. For the Republicans, I could see it the opposite perspective, where they're saying, hey, look, this is one of those spots that where we can showcase certain talent, maybe, you know, at some point. That said, the argument for going you know, nationwide to get the best person for the job is also pretty compelling as well.
But so. We've seen in the past that that hasn't necessarily worked out. Like, you know, Chief Carmen Best in Seattle, you know, they opened that up to nationwide and, you know, nothing against Chief Carmen Best. But, you know, people were outraged. They wanted, you know, they thought she should be the candidate. And lo and behold, now she is the chief of police. And Toby Nixon brought that up in Kirkland as well, that, you know, they did open it up to the nationwide search. And it's interesting, you know, the Randy with Shift Was says, you know, he just thinks that, you know, this is a power grab and, you know, is very suspicious.
I wouldn't say I have insight because I'm not part of that commission. But I just look at the results that they come up with, and they want to take power away from the people and give it to Dal Constantine and the politicians in King County. And I just don't think that that is the way to go with something as important as law enforcement.
Yeah, it seems like Dow has enough on his plate, although...
Yes, he does.
I get the impression that he has gubernatorial ambitions, and it might be one of those things where he's looking and thinking, well, looks like Ferguson's going to take this one from me. I might as well just consolidate power here and be governor of King County as much as I can. I mean, give me something else to do. I need something, and that would be it. But if for me, tie goes to the people when it comes to the election thing. So, you know, if I was conflicted, I'd say it's not broke. I think, you know, the voters have a say with the King County Sheriff's Office. The King County Sheriff's Office seems to me to have been more reliable. They've had problems from time to time, but every police agency has, because, you know, there's always going to be that with any kind of authority. With any authority, there's going to be challenges within that, any human endeavor. So I would stick with the people on that.
Well, and there's no guarantee that by opening it up to a nationwide search that you're going to get that reformer, that you're going to get, you know, that politician that's going to come in and like swoop in and solve.
Especially if they're still accountable to all the other politicians that are still right here at home. You know, I want fresh blood. I want things to change. It reminds me of the billionaire Steyer, who's running for president now. You know, and his first ad is, well, we've got all these corrupt losers in office. They're just horrible, and they're cheating the people, and I'm here to bring it back to the people. And you think, well, wait a second. You're the one that's donating to a bunch of these people. Why are you giving millions of dollars to people if they've corrupted the system and they're horrible? So, you know, again, when people say, hey, we're going to do this nationwide search, we're going to find a reformer who will really do it, and they're already in charge. I mean, they're supposed to input policy. They could create the reforms if they really wanted to. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that the one thing, too, is to bring attention to it now, because this is one of those issues where nobody really knows who the Charter Review Commission is. Like, if you went out in the newsroom, we could say, hey, what does the Charter Commission do? I mean, how many people would know that it even existed?
I bet you if we asked 100 people on the sidewalks of King County right now and we just said, yes, tell me one person on the Charter Review Commission, unless they were listening to this and heard Toby Nixon's name or something. Or if you just asked them, do you know of any review commissions that are going on right now in King County? Nobody would even name it. I mean, if one answered yes, I would be shocked.
Yeah. So if you do have a burning passion to weigh on this, you can go to the send them an email at charterreview@kingcounty.gov.
Yeah. Tell them, hey, I want to keep it elected. That's let's keep the King County Sheriffs elected. Give us somebody to root for. So thank you so much, Carolyn Osorio from Cairo. Watch for that change. Be a part of it. More coming up on the Dory Monson Show. David Bowes filling in. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. I was thinking today about recent political scandals. I think because there's been so much in the news of late, and I was remember Senator Mona Dawes of Kent, who said that there was so much hate, misogyny, and evil behind the closed doors of the Democrat caucus recently. Do you remember she said, you know, I think it was the Kent Reporter that originally reported that story. This is the state senator from the 47th district, and she said that what was the phrase? Let's see here. I don't want to get it wrong. Oh, yeah. After they closed that door, that's the door of the caucus room where it's just the Democrats. And it was on video where she says this. After they closed that door, that's when it gets real. That's when my 28 colleagues got real. That's when I heard hate, misogyny, and racism and sexism from people you would not expect. That's the type of light I want to shine. Now, when there are 8 people of color in the Senate Democrat caucus, it was coded language. Those people, they would say things that were coded, unquote. And, you know, Later, she said, well, the Kent Reporter kind of misconstrued my comments. But then you go back and watch the video, which I've watched several times on Facebook, and she said exactly that. Well, you know, there are rules in place that they're, if, you know, they're not allowed to have a hostile work environment either. So behind closed doors, which of the 28 Democrats did she hear using those people in a way that was designed to be racist, right? And since it's supposed to be getting real and she's hearing this hate, misogyny, sexism, and racism from the people, people's plural, it's more than one person. So who was she hearing it from? And remember, she came out and said, well, I really didn't hear that much. I think she told the Associated Press. It wasn't fellow Democrats. They've never said anything overtly sexist or racist. Those comments to the chamber office were referencing coded language that she hears everywhere. That does not jive with the rest of what she said on the video. She specifically said, and she specifically cited out, the Democrat caucus of the state Senate. She said, when those doors shut, that's when all this hate spews forth. And that's the how it's been so tough to be a state senator and tough on the people of color and other minorities that are working as representatives of the people in the state Democrat Senate caucus. So, you know, she says the caucus room doesn't close and horrible hate speech doesn't come out of folks' mouths. But again, now she's conflicting. So which is it? Either she was lying to the group of people she was talking about initially, or she's, you know, she's now hiding what was happening in the Democrat caucus room. And there was supposed to be an investigation of this. Remember, when after this came out, if my memory serves, the Senate said there was going to be an investigation of this behavior. And I think, I mean, can you imagine if, say, the Republican caucus room had been accused of this by a member and there was, you know, wouldn't people be asking what the results were of the investigation and asking who said it? Who did what? Who made people? What was the hate going on? You know, and if somebody's lying about it and they're saying one thing and playing for the crowd, so to speak, but by doing so, they're demonizing and slandering the people that they work with. Isn't that creating a hostile work environment in itself? So either way, it seems like that's the kind of story that should have a follow up and that people should be asking about whatever happened with that. You know, because you watch the video of the state senator and it's very clear she's making a very specific and powerful accusation against her fellow Democrats in the caucus there. And so then when she reverses course, is she pressured to do so or what? What's the reverse course coming from? You know, and if she's not pressured, does that mean she was just, you know, just spouting off in public and lying about it? You know, there's really only two options there that I can think of. So, you know, again, I just bring it up because I haven't seen any follow-up on that. And it seems to me that that would be the kind of thing that you'd have a major follow-up on, major accusation of rampant racism within the entire caucus, where multiple people are accused of creating a super hostile environment. And she's saying we're not going to be quiet. You know, she said she wanted to shine the light on it. Remember, it was, I'm going to shine the light on this. And then it's like suddenly she's like, I want to shine a light on it, but I don't want the light to be very bright. I'm going to shine a light on all the haters out there, but I want it to be like a glow stick where, you know, I mean, you get kind of a sense, a shape of what it might be, but not any actual faces or individuals. I don't want people to actually know what was said. You know, I mean, that's just, that's bogus. So, you know, seems to me that, you know, the major media needs to do a follow-up on that and figure out, was she lying? That's a story in itself, or who said it?